This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The Islamic State Group's Afghan branch has claimed responsibility for the wedding bombing in Kabul that killed at least 63 and wounded more than 180. The victims of the overnight suicide bombing at a packed wedding hall were mostly members of the minority Shiite Hazara community. The United Nations denounced the bombing as an atrocious act against Afghan Shiites. The attack was one of the worst against Afghan civilians in recent years. Sudan's pro-democracy movement signed a final power-sharing agreement with the ruling military council on Saturday at a ceremony in the capital, Khartoum. VOA's Isha Saray has more.
After months of negotiations and protests, citizens of Sudan flooded the streets to celebrate the formal signing of a political agreement that will determine the transitional government over the next 3 years. The signing itself was brief, but hours of celebration followed in the capital city. Thousands of people traveled more than 300 kilometers from the city of Atbara, where the first protests that helped to oust President Omar al-Bashir took place in December. With chants of Madaniya, which means civilian and signifies the success of a civilian-led movement, Sudanese people in Khartoum joyously celebrated the signing well into Saturday night, knowing there will be days, weeks, and months of difficult work ahead. Isha Saray, VOA News, Khartoum.
The humanitarian group Open Arms says the organization is not willing to sail to a Spanish port, given the emergency situation that they are experiencing on the boat. This after Italy's interior minister told the Open Arms ship to leave Italian waters and go to Spain. An Open Arms spokeswoman says there's anxiety, bouts of violence, control is becoming increasingly difficult. We can't put their health and lives at risk. From Washington, this is VOA News. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters marched peacefully through the streets of Hong Kong Sunday. Heavy rain fell on the protesters, but the size of the crowd showed the movement aimed at easing Beijing's control of the territory still has wide support. Protest organizer Bonnie Leung says the huge turnout shows great support for democracy, and Hong Kong's leaders must listen.
The people support the five demands, also support to stop the violence of the police and gangsters. So the campaign has the support, but the government doesn't.
China's paramilitary troops have been training in Shenzhen, which borders Hong Kong, causing concern that China is ready to send in troops to suppress the protests. Hong Kong police have insisted they are able to handle the demonstrations. A study by the UN Children's Fund finds more than 500,000 Rohingya refugee children in Bangladesh's Cox Bazar are not learning the life skills they need to prepare them for the future or to protect them from present-day abuse and exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya children have been languishing in squalid, overcrowded refugee camps in Cox's Bazar for 2 years. Ever since a mass exodus of 745,000 refugees fleeing persecution and violence in Myanmar began. The UN Children's Fund reports more than 250,000 children up to age 14 are receiving a non-formal education, while more than 25,000 others are receiving none. UNICEF and partners have provided learning to more than 190,000 Rohingya refugees in more than 2,000 centers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Three Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces, the Palestinian Health Ministry says, adding that another Palestinian man was wounded in the shooting. An Israeli military statement said a military attack helicopter and tank opened fire on a group of armed men spotted adjacent to the security fence in the northern Gaza Strip that separates Israel from Gaza. The incident happened just hours after three rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel. Authorities in Gibraltar say they are rejecting the United States' renewed request that the British Overseas Territory not release an Iranian supertanker. The vessel has been detained for over a month in Gibraltar for allegedly attempting to breach European Union sanctions on Syria. In a statement Sunday, Gibraltar's government said the ship is free to go, as U.S. sanctions on Iran had no equivalent in Britain or the rest of the EU. A massive fire has swept through a slum in the capital of Bangladesh, Dhaka, leaving thousands of people homeless. At least 1,200 tin shacks were destroyed in the slum. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The new military council would like to project to the general Sudanese people that the previous regime was corrupt. And we found this amount of money, so we would like to put him on trial.
Former Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir faces corruption charges on Monday.
Everybody is under surveillance. Everybody is arrested this way or the other. The fact that maybe I was not shot or I was not detained doesn't mean that I'm not facing threat. The law is being used, the police are being used, silence everybody who is critical to the president.
Tanzanian investigative journalist Eric Kabandera is scheduled to make a second appearance in court on Monday.
Section 14 and Section 3 are called, it is the government's natural justice equity and good conscience for you to segregate on the ground of party. Most of these ministers are the ones that are females, they have to only take a bow and go. That one is segregation against the mentor.
And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari prepares to swear in 43 members of his cabinet. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The corruption trial of former Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has been rescheduled for Monday. Local media reports quoted his defense lawyers as saying the authorities were not able to present the former president to court for the first session due to security concerns. The former president is charged with corruption, illegally receiving gifts, as well as possessing foreign currency. For analysis of the former president's trial, I reach Hassan Haji, a political science professor at the University of Khartoum.
This is probably the beginning of a series of indictments for the president here. And the first one is concerning an amount of money that found in a safe in his official residence, in his house. So this is on the eve of the military coup, about 6 million euros. Found. So he will face charges of illegal acquisition of this hard currency because in the country there is, and especially for the president, it isn't supposed to have this amount of money. So it's going to face these charges. But there are other charges concerning the overthrow of the government. This is like 30 years ago. That will come later on. But Tuesday, the trial will focus only on the acquisition of the hard currency.
But Professor Ali, some people are saying that the charges against him regarding these allegations of having foreign money and accepting gifts illegally, these are politically related charges and does not really reflect a good sense of charging a former head of state. What do you say to that?
I think probably the military council, the new military council, would like to project to the general Sudanese people that the previous regime was corrupt, and we found this amount of money, so we would like to put him on trial for this. But the defense of the former president, they said they want an open trial. That should be aired to the Sudanese people to listen to what the former president will say, how he will justify having this amount of money. So probably we are going to see a very significant drama that would unfold when the trial would start Tuesday.
Well, the former president have a fair trial. Looking at the prevailing condition at the moment, he was overthrown. Now he's going to be prosecuted or he'll stand trial about receiving gifts illegally and hoarding foreign currency. Will he receive a fair trial?
I guess this will going to be a very actually hard question because now the general atmosphere is politically charged. And also there is polarization, political polarization in the country. And a lot of people, they want the president to be charged with treason or obtaining illegal funding from foreign countries. But also at the same time, the defense, they said they have the president have legal grounds for having these amounts of money, and he's going to name people in the current military council who benefited from this money that's coming from abroad.
How independent is the Sudanese judiciary, and do you think that politics could have an influence on how this trial of the former president proceeds in a fair and just manner?
I think, if the politicians do not interfere in the process of the trial, I think it's going to be fair. But if there is demonstrations on the streets or in the press pressuring the court to take sides, not to be partial, then the trial is not going to be fair and just.
Hassan Haji is a political science professor at the University of Khartoum. He spoke with me from Khartoum. Meanwhile, the Sudanese Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition have signed a power-sharing deal. It stipulates the composition and the structures of the upcoming transitional government. Regional and international leaders have praised the Sudanese parties for reaching the agreement. Many Sudanese regard the agreement as a milestone. For VOA, Michael Atit reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The power-sharing deal stipulates the formation of a shared sovereign council in Sudan, which shall be composed of 11 members. Abdul Fattah al-Burhan will head the council for 21 months, while a representative of the Forces for Freedom and Change will lead it for 18 months. The transitional government shall last for more than 3 years. The document also creates a council of ministers which shall not exceed 20 ministers who shall be appointed by a civilian prime minister. Speaking shortly after the signing ceremony, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who helped mediate the talks, praised the Sudanese people for this achievement.
It is with the genuine vested interest in the seeing the good people of Sudan prosper and thrive that my government committed itself over the past few months to supporting a peaceful transition through to the peace-loving nature of the Sudanese people.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta congratulated the Sudanese for reaching a consensus and a mutual agreement which will lay the foundation for the civilian-led government in Sudan. He promised to continue supporting the upcoming government to work for peace and stability in the region.
I take the opportunity also to salute the patriotism of the people of Sudan, the Transitional Military Council, and the Forces for Freedom and Change for putting the interests of the people first and accepting to negotiate a journey to peace.
President Kenyatta called on all Sudanese parties to continue working diligently towards the implementation of the agreement. Speaking in Arabic, on behalf of the Forces for Freedom and Change, Naji Muhammad al-Assam saluted the Sudanese martyrs and praised their families for their support for the Sudanese revolution. He says the journey has just begun and they should continue working together towards achieving the objectives of the agreement. Al-Assam says, we don't have any choice more than to work for just and comprehensive peace in Sudan and hold anyone who committed any crime against the nation accountable to their deeds. He adds, those who denied us life together as a Sudanese, we shall continue to live now onwards, and we shall continue to live after in graves, after our death, after we have lived in a just life in this country. Al-Assam said the head of the Transitional Military Council is expected to issue a decree to dissolve the TMC and announce the Sovereign Council, which will serve as the head of the executive body in the country. The Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition are expected to announce a prime minister on Sunday, who shall also name a cabinet of 20 ministers early next week. Amru Shaban is a Sudanese journalist working for Al Sudani Arabic Daily newspaper in Khartoum. Speaking in Arabic, Shaban says if this agreement is implemented in good faith, it would put Sudan among countries that respect human rights and a political freedom. But he says the 30 years of previous regime will continue to exist as a challenge ahead of the upcoming transitional government. Amro says members of the previous regime and other political parties which were part of their government shall continue to be obstacles ahead of the upcoming government to try to distort its objectives, visions and mission of the Sudanese revolution. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, says the arrest of investigative journalist Eric Kapandera is yet another indication of the government's crackdown on the media. The group also says it supports calls for the immediate release of the journalist. Chadema's remarks follow Amnesty International's call for the immediate release of Eric Kapandera, saying charges against him are politically motivated. The journalist is scheduled to make a second appearance in court on Monday. John Malia, head of legal affairs for Chadema, says it is unacceptable for the government to continue to contravene the constitution, which guarantees press freedom and freedom of expression.
Chadema sympathizes with everybody who faces this dictatorial act being conducted by Magufuli. We have said it earlier on that the regime is turning from a democratic elected government to a full dictatorship government. And these are signs that the regime is the court and the legal system, the weak legal system that Tanzania has to operationalize its dictatorial agenda. So Chadema subscribes fully to what the Amnesty International have called for. And further to that, we subscribe fully to the sense which has been given by, in a joint statement by the U.S. Embassy and the UK Embassy in Tanzania. We really think the media arena in its completeness is under attack. And it's an attack for simple reason of criticizing Magufuli. It has been a tendency that Magufuli does not want his critique to keep on criticizing his policies and his agenda and everything. So we really think Amnesty International is right on what they say, then we call upon the Iranian government to meet that calling.
Some supporters of the government saying the government is not cracking down on media freedoms and that it is not undermining the constitution, just that the government wants to ensure that there is no fake news, that people don't use social media platforms to spread false information and fake news to cause disaffection and tension in Tanzania. Don't you think this is a good measure?
It is not. If anybody is infringing the law, the only way of encountering that is paying the poor. Because if media is reporting fake news, the government has to say which is the truth. It doesn't have to cut down the media personnel as we now. We have a report of promising journalists that will wander for more than a year now. As a journalist, like Kapandera, detained inside. So this is a very systematic, in my opinion, systematic crackdown of the media. Our Constitution under Article 18 provides for freedom of expression, and we do that through mass media. So whatever that journalists, bloggers are doing in this country, are doing it in accordance with the Constitution, and so legal to do that.
Well, the government has also come out with charges against Kapandera. What is Chadema's response to that?
It's a repetition and continuation of the persecution of people who are actually from the police. Remember when Kapandera was arrested, we were informed that it is about it. All of a sudden, he appears in court and charged with money laundering and such kind of unbearable offenses. And I think it's just a way of silencing the critique. I took what Chadema looked at it that way.
Well, some people are saying there are some critics of the government in the country. They are not being prevented from expressing their views. And they cited cases like John Malia and other prominent opposition leaders who are freely expressing their
views without fear or intimidation. So these accusations against the government are just a publicity exercise for Chadema to score political points. Your reaction to that?
It's not true. Everybody is under surveillance. Everybody is harassed in this way or the other. The fact that maybe I was not shot or I was not detained doesn't mean that I'm not facing threat. The law is being used, the police are being used to silence everybody who is critical to the president. So this, the ground here, things are so real. Situation is completely bad in terms of people criticize the government, the opposition members, the members of parliament are always important, in fact, not. So whatever that is being reported by the international media is completely correct in terms of liberty of people here and their freedom of expression.
John Malia is the head of legal affairs for the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In news from West Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is scheduled to swear in his cabinet on Wednesday. This after the 43-member cabinet designated were cleared by the Senate. The newly appointed ministers include 7 women and 36 men. Expectations are high after the president promised to assemble only those who have the ability to carry out the assignment given to them. The president made the remark following calls for him to avoid mistakes in his first term, including growing insecurity in parts of the country. To learn more about public expectations, I reached political analyst Dr. Mayenasera Ibrahim, a lawyer and human rights activist.
That the primary responsibility of government is the security of life and property of the citizenry and the welfare of the people. The number one primary expectation is that we should see the end of the insecurity in the country. It is most intolerable, it is most unexpected, it is most dishonorable for us to have 10 years anniversary of the Boko Haram in Nigeria without the Nigerian military crushing them down. We need to see the end of this insecurity. The second thing we expect to see is that you must keep Nigeria united. You must have faithfulness in the homogeneous nature of Nigeria. And we must keep Nigeria united for us to achieve progress and prosperity, which is blessing for the country. Now, for you to attain that, you have to really go about galvanizing all the nooks and corners of the country into one, so that they will be your constituency. Once you are sworn in as a minister, you have to take the totality of the continent of the Federal Assembly of Nigeria as your constituency and turn them with Section 3 of the Constitution that talks about the need for you to bring about national unity.
Some people are suggesting that this round of cabinet designates are round pegs in round hole, and that they expect this new cabinet to perform better than the previous cabinet. What is your personal view about that assessment?
I do not subscribe to that preposition. I do not subscribe to that preposition because of some factors. Number one, Section 14 and Section 3 are false. It says it is repugnant to natural justice, equity, and good conscience for you to segregate on the ground of sex, to segregate on the ground of party. Most of these ministers, are the ones that are females, were asked to only take a bow and go. That one is segregation against the men folk. And most of those that were former members of the state or national assembly, in whatever level, they were asked to take a bow and go. That is segregation based on class. So it is too early for us to really judge whether they will perform this miracle or whether they will be still in this assignment.
Talking about security, the government has repeatedly said that it has put in measures to ensure the life and property of Nigerians are protected, and that Boko Haram has been technically defeated. They don't hold sway like they used to years ago. What is your take?
Well, my take on that is that security is a global phenomenon. It is a dynamic something that is evolving new strategies by day. Every day new strategies are coming up. For example, in the past 10 years, there was nothing like this kidnapping for ransom. There was nothing like this killing. There was so every day you have to do this to continue evaluating and bringing out new strategies to be meeting up to the president. Imagine challenges that could be coming up. In Nigeria, unfortunately, we are located at a very rare speed. We need to get countries like the United States to come and design so that there will be committed and permanent entrenchment of peace after there. And apart from that, we need superior reforms. believe it is important for the international community for them to understand that terrorism is a matter of global dimension. We need to really reorient the armed forces of Nigeria so that they will be taking offensive rather than defensive position in this fight against insurgency. We are only waiting to take offensive. So the security architecture really in Nigeria needs to be restructured. The philosophy needs to be reduced. And then the drive needs to be recalibrated in the light of the international forces so that you'll be able to have it. That will help you secure a job for the killing unemployed people. And that will help you do some part of the food, which will assist you fight the one problem they're having in the country, which is hunger. And that would enable you to invite international agencies to come and invest in agriculture, which will give you foreign exchange earnings for the country.
Political analyst Dr. Mayanasara Ibrahim is a Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the continent has seen a decline in the number of authoritarian regimes since the 80s, but still, the number of democracies has not increased significantly. A report card on democracy on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back. The World Food Programme warns that millions of people in Burkina Faso are facing what it calls an unprecedented humanitarian emergency because of growing hunger, instability and displacement. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Fighting in Burkina Faso has intensified over the past 6 months, raising intercommunal tensions. Attacks, killings and targeted kidnappings by different armed groups have increased. The United Nations reports escalating fighting, some fueled by ethnic and religious beliefs, has forced more than 237,000 people to flee their homes. The insecurity and large-scale displacement, it says, has led to the closure of dozens of health centers and thousands of schools, depriving nearly 330,000 children of an education. In addition, hundreds of thousands of people are facing severe food shortages. World Food Programme spokesman Hefe Verhoosel tells VOA hunger is particularly high during the so-called lean season. This, he explains, is the period between June and September when food stocks are particularly low before the next harvest.
People have problem to find food. Sometimes problem of access, then because of the security issues, they cannot always access to the market or to go to work in the farms, for example. That's why the combination of those two problems are giving the result that we have now. People who are undernourished, we need support and urgent support, in fact, for food assistance.
Verhoosel says WFP plans to scale up its humanitarian operation to assist nearly 700,000 people. He says the beneficiaries include 220,000 internally displaced people, the same number of people in the host communities, and 250,000 people affected by food shortages during the current lean season. He says special attention will be paid to the nutritional needs of IDPs, children, pregnant, and breastfeeding women. He says they will receive nutritious food to prevent malnutrition and to treat those already suffering from this condition. WFP is urgently appealing for $35.3 million to cover needs until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria is transmitted by mosquito bites, but there are some things you can do to reduce your risk. Wear light-colored, loose-fitting clothing, including long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. Eliminate any standing water around your home, including water that collects in wood piles, taps, puddles, old buckets, water jugs and containers that livestock drink from. And if you can get one, use an insecticide-treated bed net to cover you and your children while you sleep.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the UN Human Rights Office is condemning a crackdown Friday by the Zimbabwean riot police on peaceful protesters in the capital, Harare. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva that the agency is calling for an investigation into excessive use of force by security forces.
UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says there are better ways to deal with the population's legitimate grievances on the economic situation in the country than by cracking down on peaceful protesters.
We're deeply concerned by the socioeconomic crisis that continues to unfold in Zimbabwe. While acknowledging efforts made by the government, the international community and the UN in Zimbabwe to mitigate the effects of the crisis and reform process, the dire economic situation is now impacting negatively on the realization of economic and social rights of millions of Zimbabweans.
Zimbabwe's citizens are struggling with hyperinflation, which has sent prices soaring for essential commodities such as fuel, food, transportation, and health care. Compounding the problems is the ongoing impact of Cyclone Idai that hit Zimbabwe in March and a severe drought. The United Nations says one-third of Zimbabwe's population of 16 million people is in need of humanitarian aid. The fallout in terms of casualties and possible arrests from Friday's protests is not yet clear. But Colville tells VOA his office has received disturbing reports of human rights violations over the past few months.
There are, as I said, reports coming through right now of very recent abductions, beatings and so on of activists or human rights defenders. We haven't had a chance to verify those and look in detail apart from the two that occurred a few days ago. So it's clearly a very tense situation.
Colville says state authorities have a duty to ensure people's rights to freedom of expression and to protect the right to peaceful assembly. The UN Human Rights Office is urging the government to engage in a national dialogue to ensure that civil society in all its guises can carry out its activities without fear of intimidation or reprisals for its work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Ugandan government has signed four agreements with Ethiopia aimed at enhancing cooperation between the two countries. They include a waiver of visa requirement for holders of diplomatic and official passports and a memorandum of understanding on cooperation in correctional and prison services. They also provide for cooperation in legal assistance on criminal matters and an agreement on extradition. For VOA, Mugume Davis Rakarinji has more from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The bilateral agreements were signed in Kampala on Friday. Amiria Chambade, Uganda's Minister of Trade, said the agreements will harness historical relations between Ethiopia and Uganda.
As we sign MOUs, we'll make sure that they are not just mere documents, but we are going to make sure that there are implementation strategies for us to implement all that we have pledged to do for our people of the Republic of Federal Republic of Ethiopia and the Republic of Uganda.
Ethiopia's Foreign Affairs Minister, Gedu Adagachu, agrees. Adagachu says the agreements will not only benefit Uganda, but the entire Great Lakes region.
I would like to assure you, Ethiopian government is committed to implement this agreement and to realize our vision and to benefit the people of Uganda and Ethiopia, and will strengthen our relationship, our bilateral cooperation between Ethiopia and Uganda to work together at the bilateral level as well as at the regional level.
Mwesigwa Rukutana, Uganda's Deputy Attorney General, said apart from easing travel for officials traveling to and from either country, the agreements will help track those trying to escape from justice.
Criminals can commit crimes in Uganda, run to Ethiopia, and hide themselves there. To get them out from Ethiopia, We need to have an agreement whereby we know how to treat them, how to arrest him, detain him, hold him, and how we process his transfer from Ethiopia to Uganda for prosecution. The same applies to an Ethiopian who commits an offense in Ethiopia and runs to Uganda.
This is the second time Uganda and Ethiopia have signed bilateral agreements. In 2014, the two countries signed cooperating matters of health and energy. Agreements between two countries become binding after they have been ratified by each other. Retired diplomat Harold Achema welcomed this latest initiative. Achema, who has worked in Uganda's embassies in different countries, including Ethiopia, says visa requirements should be waived not only for diplomats, but all citizens.
Ultimately, Africa will one day be one, have one continental government. And this is in the right direction. So I think this is something which I hope all African countries will eventually adopt. We don't need visas to travel within Africa, really. If many European countries can come to Uganda and just get visa on arrival, even some don't need visas, why should African require a visa to come to Uganda? Does it make any sense?
A Ugandan traveling to Ethiopia is required to apply and pay up to $100 for a visa and undergo a long application process. Observers say as economies begin to integrate, it will be more efficient to ease visa requirements. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. This is Nightline Africa Sports. Former Nigerian coach Samson Siasia has been banned for life from all football-related activities by FIFA. FIFA handed Siasia the ban on Friday for what it called agreeing to receive bribes in relation to the manipulation of matches. He managed the Super Eagles between 2010 and 2011 and for a spell in 2016. He has also coached the country's under-20s and under-23 sides. Siasia, who has not yet commented on the ban, was also fined $50,000. The sanctions stem from an ongoing large-scale investigation FIFA is conducting into the behavior of Wilson Raj Parmol, a convicted match fixer from Singapore. Siasia is the third African to be banned by FIFA for his links to Parmol after former Sierra Leone FA official Abubakar Kaba and former Botswana FA official Mokesi Kagotelele were suspended in July for 5 years and life respectively. A former international, Siasia won the 1994 Africa Cup of Nations with Nigeria, for who he played for over 50 times and scored 16 goals. As a coach, he led his country's under-20 and under-23s to continental success in 2005 and 2015 respectively. He also guided the under-20s to a runner-up finish at the 2005 World Youth Championship in the Netherlands. Meanwhile, the Guinea Football Federation has placed a life ban on former Guinean coach Paul Put and a 7-year suspension on the federation's vice president Amadou Diabe. The federation's ethics commission ruled that both Put and Diabe had allegedly breached the institution's code of ethics and its code of discipline. 63-year-old Put was in charge of Guinea at the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations, where the Sierra Leone Nationals were knocked out in the round of 16. In rugby, wing Sibusiso Nkosi scored two superb tries as South Africa continued their preparation for the World Cup by edging out Argentina in Pretoria. The Springboks' 24-18 victory was tighter than last week's meeting when they beat the Pumas 46-13 to win the Rugby Championship. South Africa named an entirely new starting 15 from last week's clash, and Nkosi impressed with his two solo tries, making it 7-8 starts for the 23-year-old since his debut in June last year. South Africa, who were beaten by champions New Zealand in the semi-finals at the last World Cup, have improved by topping the All Blacks, Australia and Argentina to win the Rugby Championships last week. Finally, in tennis, Britain's Jamie Murray and Neil Skopczycki lost their Cincinnati Masters semifinal in straight sets. They were beaten 6-1, 6-4 by Arvin Dodik and Filip Polesek in the rain heat match. A downpour stopped the game for around an hour and at 4-3 in the second set, but the delay did not affect the winning duo's performance. 33-year-old Murray and his partner reached the semis by beating his brother Andy and Feliciano Lopez in the previous round. Bosnia's Dodig and his Slovakian Polesek will play Juan Sebastian Cabal and Robert Farah in Sunday's final after they defeated Bruno Soares and made Pervic 6-3, 6-2. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And of course, you're hearing from Yemi Alade featuring Soti Soul with Africa. And Mario follows with Inatosha. And then Kore De Bello featuring Tiwa Savage ends with Romantic.
Keep it. Hata kama penzi maji masafi niacheni naye nawa. Mana yamenifika, yamenifika hapa. Ingawa nitakonda, nimelivia sawa. Mana kila dakika ni wakilioni. Kukikucha machoju na kesho kulilio penzi, hey. Kama kina loko sa mama, hey. Mama, hey. Abu shida sio heshima tu, hata wana mwingia wengi, hey. Kunzenu kupenda shaka tatama, hey. Tama, hey. We aje kabaki kuwa historia, japo sio hero safi. Ya nini kunganga niya biashara, tena yenye hasara. Na wala sisemi nitakuchukia, japo moyo hautaki. Na ya nini kunganga na ngangana, inatosha. 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 Sindikana, sawa, sina chagu. Ana japo, itani sumbua, sumbua, itani umbua, umbua. Muchanga kwenye kitumbua, tumbua, kwenye kitumbua, tumbua. Oya jega baki kuwa historia, japo siyo hero safi. Aya nini kunganga niya biashara, tena enya sara. Na wala sisemi nitakuchukia, japo moyo hautaki. Na nini kungangana ngangana, hey, inatosha. Acha nipambane na hali yangu, inatosha. Mapresha kupanda kushuka basi, inatosha. Taniwa, hey, inatosha.
Romantic, I could be a woman, womanly. I could be a woman, woman sweet. Mr. Roman.
Time to show you a shoulder, 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 shoulder. We could let London know. Girl, my baby so romantic. Oh yeah, baby, make you show them, let's show them, you show them.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. On the 7th of September, the 74th regular session of the General Assembly will convene in New York. The President of the Assembly, that session has been assigned to Africa, and the permanent representative of Nigeria, Ambassador Mohammed, has been selected as the new president of the 74th session of the General Assembly. Many heads of states all over the world will be descending on New York for that session. They will come not only to attend the meetings of the General Assembly, but they will do what is often called side meetings with bilateral partners, and many bilateral arrangements and agreements will be made. It is also necessary to bear in mind that on the 21st of September will commence what is called the General debate. This is when the member states deliver their public statements setting out their government policies and how they view the United Nations. All of this will happen. The real pressing question to ask is whether this 74th session of the General Assembly will tackle an issue which is very, very important for the international community. I'm referring to the fact that all the necessary barriers and arrangements that have been made in the Charter for the maintenance of international peace and security are all weakening, and some of them are in shatters. When the African states gained their independence in the 1960s in large numbers, they turned to the United Nations and joined the UN as a guarantee of their independence, as a protection of their sovereignty and their territorial integrity. Could any African states today truly say they look to the United Nations to protect that territorial integrity? It is hardly the case. What has happened? The reason is that during the Cold War, the Security Council was at an impasse, and the power of the General Assembly increased, and African states joined other small and medium-sized states to make the General Assembly very effective. Africans were able to use the General Assembly during this period to fight against apartheid, to fight for Namibia independence, to promote their economic development. But at the end of the Cold War, The Security Council gained all the power it had lost in the 70s and 80s. And judging by the number of meetings the Council holds now, particularly the closed meetings, and the extent of its agenda, you can say the Security Council is now a mini General Assembly. But there is also an impasse now in the Security Council, mainly after the adoption by the Security Council of the no-fly zone in Libya, a resolution which prepared the way for the end of the Gaddafi regime and also the killing of Gaddafi. And once that was done, some members of the council said they would no longer agree to such resolutions. So you do have an impasse in the council, but you do have the meetings. And what has happened is that the mighty states have now resorted to unilateral measures. They have unilateral sanctions, not through the Security Council. They have secondary sanctions to impose their unilateral measures. They ignore trade agreements and issue all kinds of trade sanctions on those who could not defend themselves. United Nations resolutions, which have been sacrosanct for years, such as the Jerusalem and its international status, the question of the settlements in the West Bank, and even the Golan Heights, which had a special resolution, all of these have been thrown away. So what do you have then? States are looking around and said, if they can do it, if the big powers can do it, why can't we do it? I mean, this is in a context you have to see what has happened to Kashmir when the Indian government removed all the United Nations conditions in that territory, which was petitioned during the partition of India in 1947. Even in Kenya last week, a parliamentarian said that Kenya would go to war against Somalia because of dispute over the maritime boundary, even though the issue is before an international tribunal. So unless the General Assembly tackles this issue, we are going to be like in the Wild West. And that should be the priority. And failure to do that, in my own judgment, will push the world to the picture envisaged by Thomas Hobbes when he talked about the life of man being brutish and short. So let the assembly rise to the occasion and not give to those critics who say it is a talking shop. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Aidan Utku, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a person with too much ambition cannot sleep in peace. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim.